Our last speaker for the morning, really, we all know Alan Lomax by his works, his reputation, and you can read about him, anthropologist, folklorist, ethnomusicologist. He is Research Associate, Department of Anthropology at Columbia University, with a project that is entitled Columbia Cross-Cultural Survey of Expressive Style. Let me please introduce Alan Lomax.
I appear to have messed up this tape I was going to play. Maybe you could straighten it out for me. Well, meetings like this dragged me very unwillingly into the period of anecdotage, which I've been resisting as hard as I could for a long time. But listening this morning to all the things that were said brilliantly by Stetson and Alan and Miss Spanks, I think I'd like to sketch in the background of the whole thing a little bit. When I came to Washington in 1933 with my father, we were in the period of the New Deal that the Roosevelts had with their young, radical assistants and associates launched for America. It was basically a rescue for the American spirit in every way, economically and artistically as well. It was the century of the common man. It was the time of the people, yes. And more than anything, almost, it was a period of the discovery and the development of the American spirit right from the grassroots. I knew the people who were running these projects. Roy Straker, the dapper, efficient man who did the FSA photographs, which now we depend on for everything about knowing what America used to look like. Ben Shawn was one of his assistants, and we used to sing songs together at the parties. And there was tall, cool Charlie Seeger, who was learning about folk music from myself and my father, and turning into the guru of the whole field of musicology, combining his vast knowledge of music theory with a great sensitivity for the music of the people, which we were bringing him from the field. And there was wonderful, hairy, inspired, valiant old Henry Alsberg, who headed the Writers Project. I stayed for a while in his house, and he nursed me through a bad period of pneumonia. And his heart was as big as the country. But basic to the whole thing were the Roosevelts. I recently found out that when Franklin had parties at the White House, he used to send everybody away but some favored secretaries and a couple of people who played the banjo and blew the harmonica. And while the secretaries danced with their gin martinis on the desks, the banjo was played, and guess what Franklin's favorite song was? I am a good old rebel, and that's just what I am, and for this land of freedom, I do not give a damn. I'm glad we fit against her, and I only wish we'd won it. I don't ask any pardon for anything I've done. Franklin was this marvelous, many-sided, sophisticated aristocrat who really could deal with the whole thing. He ran that Southern delegation, and they were the people who put the legislation through that financed all of this. Franklin fell in love with folk music in Warm Springs, Georgia. He used to pal around with the old-time fiddlers. And he had a real love for fiddle tunes. And when they asked him what his favorite song was during the campaign, he said, "Why, Home on the Range." And that made him popular from coast to coast. And it made my father's fortune in Washington. Because then he could go and ask for whatever he wanted in Congress. And what he wanted was to get the archives started. Eleanor was even more sophisticated. She loved square dancing, and all the folk singers of the period became her cronies. Josh White actually would visit her at the Summer White House in up the Hudson, and she was a familiar and sponsor of the whole thing. When the king and queen visited, she put on a concert of American folk music to entertain them that scandalized the country, where I played a cowboy and Kate Smith sang, and there was a bunch of cloggers from North Carolina. And the king and queen, who were looked from the stage like little tiny people to us sitting next to big John Garner and those Texas legislators, they were shaken by the thunder of the cloggers' feet on that Crystal Ballroom stage. I was there and saw it. Well, all sorts of enterprises were launched at the same time. All of them aimed at the big problem that America had. We had a national inferiority complex. We didn't think that we existed artistically and creatively. All of us young writers and aspiring intellectuals had that as our main problem. And so the alphabet soup theater projects, music projects, writers projects gave jobs to us all. But our big job was to show that the common people of this country had made a new and great and democratic culture. They had followed the Bill of Rights and they had pursued their own modes of happiness, and out of it had come something splendid and new. And it was our great privilege, and Stetson knows how wonderful and exciting it was to go out and record that at the grassroots. The Library of Congress enterprise was a particularly interesting one because it was the first time that a fine recording instrument had been taken to where the culture lived. So not only were we writing down the text, we were getting down the manner of the culture. And the manner of the culture is where it really lives. Its text is just a little part on top. 90% is the manner. And this is the big find of the American communications field. The whole field of the nonverbal, the whole field of the performance, the whole field of all those things that underlie this, what the speaker says. The thing in, and here language just is fitted to the top like plums in a plum pudding, but the pudding is the nonverbal, the gestural. And for the first time with this portable recording machine, we were bringing back the great part of this, and people were hearing it for the first time. It really revolutionized not only the views of people in Washington, but when we published those recordings in our first edition at the Library of Congress, they went everywhere in the world, and projects sprouted up everywhere, all over the world. It was suitable that this democracy was the first to publish its own folklore in fine acoustic form. Tracy in South America took these records and demanded finance from Decca Records, and he did the whole of British Africa. And Nataletti in Italy took the records to his government, and he went out to record Italy, and so it was all over the place. That's what the Library of Congress Folk Song Archive did in its first years. Woody and others came along, and we did their oral biographies. If I have done anything in my life that I'm proud of, I think I was the first person to do an oral history, the one about Jelly Roll. He imposed that on me. I had to do it because he needed it. Then I turned around and made it into a book, and that became the model for Studs Terkel work. But Woody, let's sing one of Woody's songs. It's a Florida song, which I think I got from the Florida Project and taught to Woody, if I remember. What is going where the climate suits my clothes? Come on. going where the climate suits my clothes. I'm going where the climate suits my clothes, Lord, Lord, 'cause I ain't gonna be treated this way. I'm going down the road feeling bad, Lord, Lord, I'm going down the road feeling bad. I'm going down the road feeling bad, and I ain't gonna be treated this way. Then comes the WPA Writers Project, and here John Lomax, who was all these years continuing to tour the country with this magical machine that he'd substituted for the original Edison phonograph, and he couldn't get over how much more wonderful this disc machine with aluminum records was, he kept on recording. And I was at the library, but my father moved over to the WPA, and he was there for 3 years. And I'm quite sure that he was the person to set up the Folklore Project with its protocols, and to launch the whole slave narrative thing. It was the thing he was most concerned about. He and Sterling Brown worked out that whole project and fought for it hard, because it was a very, very politically touchy thing. And because my father was a rambunctious Southerner, best friends of Tom Conley, he could kind of put his arm around it and even protect Henry Alsberg. And I think that's one of the reasons Alsberg hired him, because he kind of guaranteed him on the Hill in the committee at times. But anyway, he worked on that and would travel the country with a recording machine, taking down things for the archive, and working out with some of the local people. His special favorite, Ruby Pickens Tart in Alabama. She was one of the great originals that were discovered, one among many people engaged, as we've heard, in getting down for the first time what the ordinary people of this country had and were experiencing. At a certain juncture, we said, why don't we get the American Folklore Society into this thing? So we went to the annual meeting, my father and I, with a whole sample of what was being brought in, and presented it to Stith Thompson and his coterie, and said, look, we know this stuff has got faults from the systematic point of view, but it's very, very interesting, and we would like you to come in and help us make it better. So they went off into solemn conclave and came back and said, no, we're not interested. Not at all. Not in slave narratives, not in folk say, and not even in the new songs we were finding. We went out of New Haven with our tails between our legs, I'll tell you, because we needed the American Folklore Society to make us more respectable in Washington, but we didn't get it. And it must be remembered that this mapping of the unknown déclassé of America was not without its risks. My father had been fired from his first job by Jim Ferguson in Texas on the grounds that he was out there collecting these old no-account dirty cowboy songs and publishing them. And they actually fired him back in 1904. It was risky, and there weren't many who would do it. Ben Botkin from Oklahoma was an outstandingly not accepted American folklorist. They roundly condemned everything he did. All of his treasuries got bad reviews, and everything that he represented, of course, was something that the establishment in folklore was afraid of. I fear this condition still continues in the society to a considerable extent. Public sector folklorists feel self-conscious about what they do for some reason, although all folklore is in the public sector and always has been. And it's only the scholars who've taken it off into a library, saying they were going to give us a tremendous discovery about the human spirit, and so far as I am aware, not very much has come from these enormous collections and this huge amount of librarying of folklore. Not yet. Maybe it will come sometime, but we are still waiting. In the meantime, we decided to take our stuff right to the people. And so we went on the air with radio programs. We published discs, and Ben was publishing his books. And there were regional books everywhere. Saxon's Gumbo Yaya about New Orleans, Thompson's Body Boots and Breeches. He was one of the unconventional ones in New York. Hurston's Mules and Men, Kennedy's Palmetto Country, which I think is probably the nicest, of the liveliest, the wittiest, the saltiest of all these regional books. I want to quote a few things from it because I think it's been terribly neglected. I don't know whether you all have actually read it recently, but it is full of great things, great things. Page 67, something from a slave narrative. My whipping boss was Mr. Joe Snyder. He had his pets among the women and let them off sometimes. But the worst he ever gave them was a pop over the head with a battling stick. He had his pets among the men folks too, and sometimes he'd only slap them over a barrel and give them a few licks with a bullwhip. But those who tried to run away got frammed out plenty. He'd tie a rope around their waists and hoist them up until only their toes touched the ground. Then he beat them all over the back and rump with a heavy wooden paddle drilled full of holes. Every hole made a blister. Then he made them lie down on the ground and taken a rawhide whip and busted them blisters one at a time. Well, recording this kind of thing in those days was a risky affair, both risky at the time for the person who gave it to you, for yourself, and for the person who published it the first time. Stetson looked at the other side, as he always does, and he has a story from a slave master, an unconventional fellow who said, whereas I am, who made his will, saying, whereas I'm of sound mind and a disposing memory and know what I'm doing, and whereas I know perfectly well that it's against the laws and conventions of life to marry a colored person, and whereas this is my property and it's not anybody's damn business what I do with it, and whereas I have an African wife and believe that the amalgamation of white and colored races is to the best interests of America, and whereas I know that I'm not about to do is going to bring down tremendous criticism, but I don't give a damn. Now, therefore, I give to my wife, Anna Magyan High Kingsley, 1/12 of my estate, and so forth. Stetson, along with all of us, we're taking a new stand against the apartheid that existed here. And I think it was one of the most important things that we did. Blacks were beginning to feel that they had someone to talk to, and the word was getting out through the culture. One of the things that happened in Washington, and I believe it was maybe our most important function at first, we were reporting directly to all the people who were running the New Deal. We were singing, my job was to go to parties and sing songs to them that came in the Library of Congress, and they were inspired by this to continue doing what they had set out to do, which was to create a country with more social justice and a fair division, economically speaking. So they were heartened by this in this first feedback process. Soon we were on the air, and that thing was working for the whole country. But the process was most important in Washington. Another one of Stetson's discovery was what I think is America's finest piece of mythology. It's about it's about West Hell. West Hell, heaven, Diddy Wah Diddy, Jenny Gall, and Methuselah and Czar have a very real place in the imagination of Palmetto Country's black folk. West Hell is situated some distance from regular hell, and it's the hottest and toughest suburb in that torrid resort. Only the most wicked sinners are confined there, and their souls are first transferred to rubber caskets so they can bounce them to their destination without having to be toted. Well, old Big John flew into hell on the back of an eagle, and he fell in love with the devil's youngest daughter, and they eloped on the devil's favorite steeds, Hallowed Be Thy Name and Kingdom Come. Then Big John married the girl, but before he left, he hauled out on ice water to everybody, handed out ice water to everybody, and turned down the dampers. He said he and his wife might want to come back and visit her folks someday, and he didn't want the house kept so hot. He said if he came back and found that the devil had opened those dampers up, he'd tear the whole place down and make hell into an ice house. There was a rumor at that time in Zorro's community, and a justified one, that Negroes were banned from heaven. One got in and was issued his wings, and he flew so recklessly that he was grounded. When Gabriel discussed this with him, the black man said, "I don't care if I never got him back, but I was a flying fool while I had him." There was Diddy Wah Diddy. Diddy Wah Diddy was a place where the curbstones made good sitting chairs and all food was ready cooked. Sweet potato pies came along with knives and forks stuck in their middle. And finally, there was Czar. I don't know whether Stetson did this or Zorro did this or a folk did this, but Czar I love. Czar, very little is known about it because no one who's ever been there has ever come back. It's on the far side of far. So Stetson and his like were doing the courageous thing all over the country. And it was often personally dangerous, as I pointed out, to work this way in the nick of time. We were in the nick of time, as Stetson has pointed out. Zorro is an example of how you were paid by the society for doing that. Zorro, I spent a summer with in the field, and then I knew her quite well in Haiti and other places. And she was ardor. She flamed. She filled the whole room with her dynamism as a performer and as someone who cared about what she was doing. She made the most wonderful field notes that you could imagine. She could sit at a session and then 2 hours later write out literally whatever she heard. It was wonderful in the field with her. And during one of her big achievements was to put together a folk company of singers and actors and take a folk play to Harlem, A Day in the Life of a Railroad Camp, where the people who were actually in the railroad camp did this whole wonderful song cycle, where there's a song for every operation on the railroad and some for gambling. I heard one from her there about gambling, which is a great American tune. Let the deal go down, boys. Let the deal go down. If your card get lucky, well, partner, you're in a rolling game. Bam! Let the deal go down, boys. Bam! Let the deal go down. The play was put on in Harlem, and it was a complete flop. The Harlem of that day was disturbed and resentful that they had been faced with this lower class image of themselves. Zorro was heartbroken. I don't think she really ever got over it. It was, you know, it was years and years, nothing like it's ever been done, even up to now, although there are recent moves in that direction. And Zorro moved away from her black friends, and Edna Ferber helped her, and then the great Miss Barnacle from New York University helped her, and that's how we got together on a field trip that Barnacle had organized. But Zora really lost her people in that period, and she became something of a segregationist herself in all of her bitterness, and, as you know, died in terrible poverty in Miami. And now, of course, biographies and all this in her honor. And she's the most celebrated of black women. But that's what she got for doing what she did a little too soon. And with a little too full of heart. It's dangerous to work in the nick of time. Stetson, who was even more valorous than any of us, took his cue from that Ku Klux Klan story and went after the Ku Klux Klan, and thereafter he had to do a lot, he had to stay in hiding a lot of the time, because he really took folklore to its final conclusion. I'm going to try to stamp out the thing that is making the life of my informants impossible and hideous. And I think that potential is always there, always there. The people who occupy the positions of power in any region are very content to have a mass of people who work for low wages and don't know anything and are ignorant and are subject to them because their manners are not proper, they don't speak the right language, they have the wrong dialect, they don't live in proper houses, they have outdoor toilets, you name it, all those things. But that puts a whole group of, makes a whole group of people available for exploitation. And there is opposition every time you move across this barrier, no matter where you are. Even as an anthropologist going into the field, you hit this middle class, upper class antagonism wherever you go. And we hit it all the time in our early work. And it hurt because you were excluded and you were attacked and sometimes jailed. I was arrested for trespass when I crossed the county in Coahoma County, Mississippi. We were taken in by the FBI, myself and my field party from the Library of Congress, and we had to register as if we'd entered a foreign country. This was the way it used to be in the nick of time. It was exciting, but problematical. I'd like to play you, I don't know how much more time I have or whether you're interested. What happened to my little tape? Does somebody know how to work this machine? Could you rewind it and get it back to the front of A side? I think there's another piece of the text about the nick of time, which I want to share with you. Going back to this idea of the 90% and the 10% of communication. The reason that I still continue to always try to record the oldest, the most conservative, quotes, source that I can in culture, and I'm interested in that, is because in my recent world study of folk song, I found that from these, quotes, old and pure documents, I'm finding the traces of tremendously ancient traditions of human continuity. It's been possible using the computer to put this evidence together to show that from the beginning of culture, there have been enormously strong, very steady, powerful streams of culture flowing that in their combinations and permutations account for almost everything that we know about music and dance and expressive behavior. So that for me, the documents from the oldest level are terribly, terribly important. The more authentic, the the better. The more completely recorded with film, if possible, the better. Because you see in the movement the sources for the, especially for the rhythmic organization, a recent find. The difference between white swing and black swing is that the blacks are doing their phrasing with their bodies as well as with the ends of their fingers. Sometimes the phrase, you've seen these wonderful clarinet phrases and the trombone phrase that is notorious in Durlin's art. But there's always some phrasing going on. It varies from phrase to phrase, and it's that variety that accounts for the incredibly complex and changeful texture in white jazz, and black jazz is against that of white on the whole, because we tend to keep our bodies rather still and maintain our composure and play music like this. It's a good way to go, but it's not entirely useful for jazz. Now, it's this kind of thing that the documents give us. And going back to my old field recordings, I find these sorts of messages all over the place that I didn't perceive when I was just a kid with Zorro in Eatonville. This is a wonderful, relaxed atmosphere. I added to it by passing for color. It was the only way I could live there. So I, at Zora's direction, put tanning on my skin. And, of course, all the blacks knew perfectly well that I wasn't really colored because they could look up under the sleeve and see. But it made them feel comfortable, and it made it possible for me to stay there overnight without the police knocking at my door. So I could go through a couple of peaceful weeks there without being bothered. The denouement wasn't so nice, but that's from my biography. But we heard wonderful things there. Here's a work song. How do you turn this on? Is that it there? That stops and starts it?
This will stop.
What?
This will start.
Okay. We forget that very often that the whole Caribbean area is different from the rest of north of the New World because in order to settle it, in order to clear the land and do the work and make the economy go, blacks had to be brought from Africa. They're the only people who could work in the temperature. Las Casas saw that, and so slavery began and continued for that because most white folks sat under the shade. I had to sit under the shade even while I was recording. Sometimes, one time I got sunstroke when I got a little too high in the altitude. I just recording while the blacks were clearing the field in front of me. But that's the story of this whole part of the world. It was created by blacks who were experienced tropical agriculturalists and knew what to do, how to take care of animals, how to do the rice, how to do the cane, the whole thing. They did it. And in order to keep their spirits up, during this forced labor, which was different from Africa, because in Africa, the work songs were very much more relaxed and loose, and there was a lot of joking and laughing and kidding around and stopping. We got these unison songs like sea shanties because these people could not ever stop. If they began to slack down, look out. What you get in the head, man, with a stick, what you got. Here is one of those work songs from the railroad.
Like a
boo.
Can't you move it? Hey, can't you try? There come a woman walking across the field, a mouth is talking like an automobile.
Here come a woman coming across the field, her mouth exhausting like an automobile. A great couplet out of the great bag of black poetry.
Hey, hey, can't you try? Oh, shack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack-a-lack
lack a lack a lack a lack a lack a boo.
Catch a move, hey, hey, catch a drive.
Here's another piece of African survival, beautifully presented in a recording that I made with Zora's help of a guy playing the harmonica. Now, the African approach to instruments is to make them talk, make them laugh, and make them shout, make them do all kinds of things. You don't just take an instrument and get one pure tone that you continue all through the song. You change with every phrase if you can. You put every kind of variety. Changefulness is the very source of African musicality, as we discover. More common, more frequent there than anywhere else in the world. And here you have the talking, yipping, yelling instrument doing a fox hunt. Very much like the lion hunt played on African fiddles that we know from the Sudan. Never done any better than by that Florida black who's sunk into the past of the archive. Well, the idea was, of course, to get these things out where people could hear them. They still are mostly there waiting to be heard. And this is a challenge, I think, that we all have in front of us. How are we going to get a hearing for all of this? What are we going to do about it? The next piece is fascinating because from the Levee Camp song, which is, so far as I know, the only real African tune surviving in America, the Levee Camp song of the Mississippi Valley, which spread all over the South with the mule skinners culture from the Mississippi. That song is being turned into a blues by the singer and player here. And that's how the blues actually began, the Levee Camp song being converted into a blues. But this document from Florida is the only one I know where somebody is actually doing it in front of your ears. So it was from the hollers that were then made into dance music that the blues actually came in Mississippi. And, of course, that has now become the main melodic language of humanity, that obscure song from Mississippi. And here we go on. Captain called me this morning. I'm over time. Shall I go on for a little bit more? Because there are a few more things I wanted to play you and say. Here's a work song into blues, and I have three more tunes to play. This is a song, Muley on the Mountain, called Injury. You might say this is the main song of all the prison gangs, all the work gangs of the whole East Coast. It has wonderful lines in it. Every mail day I get a letter, son, come home. I can't read them for crying. The tears roll down. Captain call me a nappy-headed devil. That ain't my name. One day I'm going to get me a shooter, I'm going to blow him down. That's all in the song, murmuring out of the ditch with the, has the manner of flat weeding and cleaning the roads. And here it is sung as a work song and then turned into a blues. His mama calls me soon this morning. This is in his dreams, the prisoner's dream. Call me soon this morning at the break of day. Dirty and I was wondering about what she said. Now an anecdote from the way back in the period. I was in the library most of the time, although I made lots of cruises around the country doing all kinds of sometimes non-English language songs and surveying the rest of the country that my father wasn't looking at. We did the whole thing west of the east of the Mississippi during those years. He came in one day from Florida, and at that time, the archive consisted of a table about this long, about two floors down in the Library of Congress, and there was a little bit of light coming in this way, and it was very dusty. And we had a recording machine here, and the archive was piled around the table. And that was it. We had some travel money, and I made $16.20 a year. And we sometimes ran out of something to eat before the end of the month on that. But anyway, Father said, I want you to hear this thing I found in Florida. And we sat there in this dusty, strange place and wept as we listened to Roscoe McLean, who was a man dying of tuberculosis in Rayford, sing. He sang this song first. Mama, mama, make me a garment and make it long, wide and narrow. Mama, mama, you will find some money. Come gather round, boys. Come gather round me. Come pay my fine. Come and get me. And then he sang, go down, you little red, red ruby rising sun, and don't you never bring day, great God Almighty, no more, to the pine, where the sun, great God Almighty, don't shine. You gotta shiver, oh, in the cold. Lord Almighty, a wind blows. Now I wish to my soul that old bald-headed judge was dead and green grass growing round. Oh, Lord Almighty, his head, cause I ain't killed no man. I ain't robbed great and got a mighty no train, and I ain't did no man. Well, Lord Almighty, no crime. Mama, oh mama, come and pray. Oh, Lordy, for your child, and I will never do wrong. Well, my Lord Almighty, no more. There are always those at the top who try to convince us constantly that we've arrived at the nirvana, that everything is okay, in spite of the number of people who are clearly suffering and all the things that are wrong. But the restless souls at the bottom of the society are always able to remind us in vivid terms like these, that the struggle for justice is never over, that the victories of the revolutions of the 18th century are just beginning. They only set the goals to be realized. The Bill of Rights must always be defended, always be fought for. We need to add a new leg to the Bill of Rights, I believe. The idea of cultural equity, where all the plurality of cultures can have their time on the air, their time in the classroom, properly recognized and properly represented, the way they do things in their styles. This is a grand opportunity that lies before us. This is the job for the folklorists of the future.
Thank you so much, Alan, for those wonderful words. Very inspiring. We now have some time, about an hour, before we have to be back. Less than that, actually. Tina would like to say something. Yeah. So, thanks.
For those of you that are unfamiliar with the area, and I know many people are here from out of town, since we only have a short time, I'd like to just make a couple suggestions about restaurants within a few blocks of the historical museum. If you